Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenplay Podcast, episode number 3. Good writers borrow, but great writers steal outright. Aaron Sorkin.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenplay Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenplay Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by 3 categories: micro-budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Now, I'm actually really super psyched about today's guest. He is a screenwriter with some credits of a few movies you might have heard of, like Bad Boys, Die Hard 2, just to name a few, and then going in the 90s echelon of great action movies, Money Train, starring Wesley Snipes, Woody Harrelson, and a young Jennifer Lopez, and the Bruce Willis vehicle Hostage as well. I mean, his stories are remarkable. He was there at the beginning of the filmmaking careers of Will Smith and Michael Bay. And the stories that he was able to tell us on air is pretty remarkable. Just the stories with Michael and Will, as well as the geniuses that are Jerry Bruckheimer and Don Simpson, as well as the story of how the hell he got to write the sequel to Die Hard, one of the greatest, arguably if not the greatest action movie of all time, in my humble opinion. If it's not the one, it's definitely on the top 3 action movies of all time. But he tells us a story how he was able to get that job, how he works in the Hollywood system, how he continues to work in the Hollywood system, how he's now turned into writing a lot of novels. He's a very accomplished novel writer as well. But we got a lot of the inside skinny on what goes on behind the scenes of these really big budget films and working with these big movie stars and big movie directors and big movie producers. So it was such an enjoyable conversation with Doug. Doug was so cool. And I can't wait for you guys to hear it. So sit back, grab a cup of Joe, and enjoy my conversation with Doug Richardson. I'd like to welcome to the show Doug Richardson, man. Thank you so much for taking out the time, buddy. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
So let's get into it, man. How did you become a screenwriter? Like, what made you want to jump into this crazy business?
Well, I wanted to be a filmmaker. I wanted to be a film director, in fact, like so many kids with movie cameras and who used to go, you know, sneak away and skip movies at the mall and from theater to theater, you know, just kind of a 1970s movie geek.
Mm-hmm.
And then, went to film school because, you know, that's kind of a natural progression.
Mm-hmm.
Saw that I kind of liked that movies were written. And a lot of the directors I really admired were guys who had written movies before. So I thought I would write my way into the business after I got out of school. And I did. In doing so, I kind of became a screenwriter instead of a film director.
Gotcha. And you went to USC, correct?
I did.
How was that back then?
Back then when we were in the Quonset huts?
Yes.
Before George Lucas and Steven Spielberg and everybody built them a mini Warner Brothers.
I just spoke there. I just did a lecture at USC, and for the first time ever, I walked around. You're absolutely right. It's like a mini Warner Brothers.
That was what it was supposed to look like. It was supposed to look like the Warner studio. It's supposed to leave the interiors and all the all the architecture and stuff was supposed to look like, yeah, you know, Warner's, except it's in better shape.
Oh, it's brand new. It's like 3 years old.
we were in World War II Quonset huts on another part of campus. It was just this little tiny quad of Quonset huts.
Jesus. So it wasn't as well respected back then?
It was extraordinarily respected. It was smaller though.
Okay.
As in there were fewer students that could there were only 20 students per year.
Oh Jesus.
In both the grad programs and the undergrad programs are only 20 each. It was tiny. So it was more competitive in some regards. And you know, by the time you finished, there were only like 15 each because people would have dropped out and moved on. So it was very interesting and probably very different.
Wow, man. Wow. And were you there around the time that George and Stephen?
I was there after. Stephen was not, by the way.
He never went. That's right.
He went to Long Beach. I was there, you know, after.
Uh-huh.
So he came and spoke and showed us, you know, he came and talked to us and gave like some of the best advice you could ever get, which was, you know, film school will not teach you anything about filmmaking. But it is – no, it won't. It won't.
No, you're right. I completely agree.
It will provide you a great, you know, laboratory in which to teach yourself. And that was very, very true. Because there's some people who got through my program, and I swear when they got finished, did not know where to put a camera. You know, even in the most basic setups and stuff. So versus, you know, a lot of us, you know, got our start there and moved on. And I had a pretty interesting class. So some, you know, Ken Kwapis was not in my undergrad class, but the undergrads and the grad students went along in tandem.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there were a lot of the classes were the same. So you were mixed in with the grad students. And so, yeah, so guys like Ken Kwapis and Stephen Bloom and
all those guys
done some work since then.
Kind of went a few things
with us. You know, Andy Davis, the producer Andy Davis, not the director Andy Davis. And,
mm-hmm.
and amongst some others.
Andy Davis if it's the same guy I'm thinking, is it the guy who did The Fugitive?
No, that's the director Andy Davis.
Oh, okay.
There's the Andrew Davis, the producer who's just produced a lot, been a real go-to line guy out there. He works and works and works.
Awesome. So when you write a screenplay, like what's your process? I know every screenplay, every screenwriter has a unique process. What's yours?
I don't know if mine's that unique. I mean, my process is do whatever I need to do to serve the project. Okay. You know, so there's no real... I put everything on cards. I outline. I go into a park and write on a bench the way Ron Bass used to, or mm-hmm. whatever, or sit in restaurants and listen to dialogue. I would just sort of, you know, if I felt a movie really required, you know, if it was an action movie, for example, you know, like Die Hard, for example,
mm-hmm.
that I felt was a, you know, kind of a bit of an action opera. Mm-hmm. That's something I felt like needed to be put on cards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, versus if it's something that's more of a thriller that's kind of need to be felt, or if it's something that just there was a lot of, you know, a drama that, you know, a lot of that is just research. And then sometimes the outline can be something on paper. Sometimes it can be just notions on paper, slightly organized, until eventually I get down to sitting down and writing it. And then the process is then probably very normal. I get that. I write it. By the time I get done with the first draft, there's a ton of stuff I already want to rewrite. I rewrite it and rewrite it until it's ready to kind of hand out and give to people to read.
Now, are you one of those writers that kind of like gets the idea and starts beating it up in your head first? Or do you use the cards and you use the outlines to kind of beat it up? Cause I like when I write, I always beat it up in my head for probably a week or two before I even put anything to paper.
I have stuff in my head all the time. I have things that form, I'm sure since you're a writer, you understand this. Some things form very quickly
mm-hmm.
and you can get them on paper. And some things, like I said, are still in my head that I think are really great notions, but haven't yet formed into something that I'm either going to write a screenplay or as I do now, which is I write more books than screenplays.
Gotcha.
But you know, is it, you know, it's, you know, there are notions in there that I say there's a movie there somewhere.
It just it hasn't come.
It hasn't come together yet. So, but still, yeah, it has to come together in my head before I start, you know, to put it down on paper. Because then it's, you know, when I start to put stuff down on paper, I have no idea what's. I mean, almost everything I put down, I've kind of run through my head.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. Now, are you? Obviously, you're a working screenwriter, and you've done many, many movies over the course of your career. What is the process of you actually getting a writing assignment? Like, how does that work? So the audience can understand a bit of how it works in the studio system. Like, your agent gets a call, you go to the pitch.
There's the old days, and there's nowadays, which is very, very different in the last 30 years. Things have changed, and then there's cycles too. Mm-hmm. You know, whether they're buying specs or they're buying pitches, and what kind of pitches they're buying, and they want you to come in with a whole. Nowadays, they want you to come in with a whole. You know, sometimes with almost the marketing campaign, because they, you know, versus. I remember this wasn't my pitch, but back a long time ago, Dale Lawner walked in. And the pitch was, she's blonde, she's beautiful, just don't get her drunk. And that was it.
That was a green light.
Oh, Blind Date.
Oh,
and they made that movie, but that was the pitch.
I actually love that movie.
That was the myth of the pitch, at least.
At least the myth of, yeah, because that's a great movie back in the day.
And I used to have, you know, back in the days when there was more development, and they were more interested in buying an idea with a writer, and it didn't quite need to be as formed, and they would actually be part of the forming of it process. Mm-hmm. You could go in, and I did go in. Sometimes I would only go in with a first act, or I would go in with just, you know, a character and a couple characters in a situation, and they would say, yeah, that's cool, let's try it. And, you know, a deal would be made, or, you know, and you'd go start the research or whatever, and you'd eventually write the movie, but a deal would be made. Now, they kind of almost, again, want the story to be fully baked. They want three acts, and they want, like I said, practically a marketing campaign. Whether it's something, back to your question, whether it's a, you know, my agent calls me and says, DreamWorks is looking for a haunted house movie, you know, mm-hmm. and didn't you have one? And when you go into DreamWorks, you know, DreamWorks wants more than just, hey, I have this idea for a haunted house movie.
Right.
The executives want to, you know, unless you're pitching the guy who can say yes or the woman who can say yes, mm-hmm. who's the boss, and generally you're not at that point, you're pitching something that they need to be able to take upstairs to their boss. The guy who says yes, or take to their big meeting and to the group and see if they can say yes and be competitive with it. You know, so sometimes they want more ammo than just the story. You want to kind of tell them, you know, this is, I mean, now it's like they want, you know, what's the demographic? And is this fit? No, it's
right.
Serious.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. They want stats. They want reports.
Does this fit our marketing scheme? How we see, you know, do we have a, can we imagine a slot for this? You know, which is, again, very different than 20 years ago when they just made stuff that they really liked and only they developed stuff that really liked it. Only after they developed it to a place that they really, really loved it would they then say, okay, now, you know, how do we approach, how much do we spend on it? How would, you know, and then the marketing guys would come in and how would we market it and how would we,
right,
are we
right.
going to open it on a lot of screens? Are we going to open it on just a couple of markets? You know, so that's, now it's just, it's very pre-packaged and pre-digested and pre-marketed.
So it's before you might have had.
If you're not in the indie business, sorry. I'm talking.
Right, of course. The indie business is a little bit different. But like, do you think that's kind of the whole corporatization of like the McDonald-ing of?
Yeah, no, films? That's when the corporations bought Hollywood. There was a lot of different. There's a lot of talk for a long time about how it was going to spin out, uh-huh. you know, and people had different ideas, you know, where movies going to be. And then, you know, there's the whole DVD part of the business.
Yeah.
And videotape part of the business where, you know, you are begin like a product and you're fighting for, you know, square feet of shelf space, you know, or linear feet of shelf space at Blockbuster or Walmart or someplace. No one really knew that it would sort of end up going more where the marketing guys moved way deep into the creative side to where movies were actually made more to fit a marketing scheme than they were to fit something that an audience is going to love.
Right.
They're kind of almost reverse engineered. This is a marketing scheme that we know we can sell. We've been very successful with this kind of marketing scheme. What can we find that fits that model?
I think one of the movies of this year, that kind of broke what you're talking about, and it was a huge monstrous hit to the surprise of the studio, was Deadpool. They kind of snuck it in. And then the marketing guys made this brilliant marketing campaign, but that was one of those films that I think just kind of...
Risky film for them, and it was an anomaly for them.
Yep.
It wasn't an anomaly. I think they knew they had something they liked, and they knew they were going to have to sell it differently. They clearly had a ball with it.
Yes, they did.
They certainly had a ball with it, and then on top of it, the movie delivered, and you've got this massive breakout hit. Now, is that now a new marketing scheme that they're going to try and fit again for something other than Deadpool?
Well, Wolverine is going to be an R-rated. The next Wolverine will be the R-rated.
Are they going to do – I mean, people thought Warner's was going to do that with Suicide Squad. You know, that they were really going to, you know, aim for, you know, but I think Warner Brothers was really deep into Suicide Squad before Deadpool came out. So perhaps they didn't do that. I think, you know, audiences may have been hoping for something with more of an edge. But did that create a new marketing scheme, or is that sometimes they see that and they just write them off as anomalies?
Right. Of course. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I completely agreed. But I think there is going to be a little bit of a shift. But again, that budget too was almost $50 million or something like that. It wasn't in the studio world. That's nothing.
No, it was in the studio superhero world. It was an experiment.
Yeah.
It's an experiment. That used to be, hey, this is Deadpool. This is cool. Yeah. This is how much we're willing to risk on it. You guys go make it. We'll figure out how to market it.
Yep.
Okay. That's how it used to be. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, it's looked upon as a lab rat.
It's so crazy.
And not as left. Cool. We should make it. The movies from the period I grew up on, I mean, some of my favorites like Midnight Cowboy and Taxi Driver and some
of the films from back then. Can you imagine Midnight Cowboy? Can you imagine Midnight Cowboy today from a studio?
But the studio that made it, the response was this: we love that. This is amazing. We have to make it. It's incredibly risky. So we got a director, we got the script, we got the producer, whatever. You guys go make this film for $1.4 million. Don't spend a penny more.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Go make it. Don't spend a penny more or we'll kill you.
Yeah.
You know, and then they come back with the movie and then they say, great, we've got this. And it bloomed. It's everything we thought it should be. Now we've only risked $1.4 million on it. Let's come up with a way to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
But they made it because they loved it. They didn't turn away movies that they didn't love. They saw something they love because they love movies and they wanted to make it. Sure, some they saw as like just
money grabs.
Franchises and we're going to make them because, you know, they make money. But some they would read and they would say, oh my gosh, we have to make this. This has to be ours.
Right.
And they would figure out how to do it. Now, loving something is dangerous because you're not thinking your way through if it's going to be a marketing thing.
Do you believe in this whole Hollywood implosion eventually? Like, you know, all these big tent poles are just, they just keep rolling the dice so much that eventually they're going to have a bomb. Like, you know, Batman versus Superman.
There already have been bombs. And
but like massive.
But they're, is there Heaven's Gate? No, there's no, because there's all the parent companies can withstand the parent companies, the other corporatization is that the parent companies can withstand the bomb. Mm-hmm. That's the, you know, and they've again been able to.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Pre-digest them and pre-market them in such a way where their risk is still somewhat, you know, minimal.
Right.
So it won't kill the studio. It may make them shift a little bit. I don't think it's going to be an implosion. I think it's going to be a slow erosion of
cinema.
Well, no, it's going to change. Cinema's going to be there. There's always people are always going to want to go sit in a dark theater, I think, and see something really great.
Yeah.
It might be small. Where it goes as far as, you know, the independent world and what you're able to make independently, and theaters, exhibitors willing to book independent films, and there being a market for people wanting to go out. One thing they've done is they priced themselves out of – they priced the regular moviegoer out of the theater as a regular moviegoing experience, because mm-hmm. they've been so greedy with that. And okay. that I've been really expecting for a while. I think that really hit home this summer with some movies. You know, it's like, oh, what are we going to see? We're going to see the BFG or Finding Dory, you know, yeah. or we saw Finding Dory and, oh, kids, sorry, you want to see the BFG?
Sorry.
We already spent that $150 for that night out.
Yeah, I know.
This month.
Yes.
And we're not going to go see another movie for another month. So I think... You know,
it's very true. I have twin daughters, and every, you know, I went to go see Zootopia, and, you know, we went to go see Finding Dory, and but at a certain point, you're like, and they said, I think that we went to go. My wife took them to go see Secret Lives of Dogs or Pets or something like
right.
that. And that, you know, when like Ice Age came out, we're like, BFG,
yeah,
like I'm not gonna go see, because it's $50, $60.
Just in tickets, and then there's the popcorn.
No, I always bring in my popcorn.
Okay, well, you're that guy.
I'm that dude. Absolutely.
Well, your kids are learning to be frugal. Still, absolutely. It's $50.
Yeah, but still, yeah.
The cost of seeing a movie have gone up crazy compared to
$5 or $6. When I was in high school, it was $5 or $6.
Compared to the cost of living everywhere else.
Right.
It's gone. I mean, and when they came, the other greedy thing is that I thought was. I kind of felt was going to happen. As soon as they learned they could charge a premium price for 3D, then sure, they're going to pay to have movies in 3D and charge the premium price. But the 2D prices just crept up right behind them.
Yep. And now don't forget the big theaters that are special theaters that have the special seating and the special sound and the – and those are like, you know, extra money, ultravision or whatever. It's just all, you know, all sorts of different things. And, you know, well, I mean, we've gone completely sidetracked off our conversation.
I know, but it's fun. And by the way, but from a writer standpoint, these are important things to know and understand. You need to understand the business in which you work and the people and the perspectives of the people which you're working for, you know, you're doomed to, in some respect, to failure.
Well, let me ask you a question. Now, you know, you worked in a time where, you know, the studios were a lot different, like we've been talking about, like now, you know, a lot of your earlier work in your career, you know, that was a different kind of time. I can only imagine, like, every year that goes by, there is a new crop of screenwriters coming into the marketplace. But yet, the old crop of screenwriters are still working as well. But yet, the number of studio movies are going down. So now the competition to get even... try to get a studio movie made at any level, even, you know, a smaller level like a Lionsgate for $20 or $30 million for certain movies, if that even exists much anymore, is getting harder and harder and harder. Because, you know, you've been, you know, you wrote Die Hard 2 and you wrote Bad Boys and you wrote a bunch of studio movies back then. Well, you're not gone. You know, you're still in competition with the new 20-year-old or the new 25-year-old screenwriter that's submitting their
stuff. Which I choose to be.
I'm sorry?
If I choose to be.
Yeah, exactly. If you choose to be. So, well, let's get back to screenwriting real quick. There's two camps that I've heard of, and they are the plot camp and the character camp. Do you sit on one side, or do you do both, or you have a foot in both?
Some people might argue, based upon my oeuvre of film, at least those that have been made. You know, I've written a lot more screenplays than pictures that have been made. Uh-huh. I really think I prefer a balance of both. Mm-hmm. I think character drives plot, mm-hmm. so I'm definitely character first. Unless you have an agenda and a character with an agenda that has, or characters with agendas that create some sort of conflict, mm-hmm. Then you have no story at all. But you still have to be an architect of plot to kind of get there, because it is a movie and especially it's a movie. So, I mean, you've got 90 minutes to 2 hours and 50 minutes generally, in which you're going to have to tell the story. So, you know, the screenplays, they say, are structural. Well, architecture is there's a lot of plot involved in architecture.
So plot would be the car and character would be the engine.
Yeah.
Got
sure.
it.
Sure. I guess.
If that's a good analogy or not.
Yeah, but that's works for me.
So you wrote one of my favorite movies in the 90s, Bad Boys. How did you get the Bad Boys gig, and how did that come to be?
That was just one of those, you know, right place, right time kind of things. Mm-hmm. Don and Jerry had a whole lot of movies. Don Simpson, Jerry Bruckheimer, mm-hmm. were coming back from their sort of lean period and had three movies ramping up at once: Dangerous Minds, Crimson Tide, Bad Boys. And they had this director named Michael Bay, who'd never directed anything but some videos and some commercials. Mm-hmm. And they had half a script, literally half a script that they just stopped, even though there had been many scripts beforehand. Huh. It had been in development for like 11 or 12 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wasn't it Danny Carvey and John Lovitz originally?
There was a version of the movie with Michael Bay directing 6 months prior to my being involved. It was a Dana Carvey, John Lovitz vehicle.
That's
and
so funny.
Then that fell apart, and they started mess with the script again, and they just stopped in the middle, because when they got, they had these two TV actors, you know, Will Smith and Martin Lawrence, who had hiatuses between their shows. Mm-hmm. They were both going to be on hiatus around the same time. Someone had the bright idea. Whether it was Jerry or Lucas Foster, who was that time running their company, mm-hmm. To put them all, my guess is it was Lucas, mm-hmm. to sort of like we got the director, we got this hot young shooter, and we got these two interesting guys. And Martin and Will came aboard, and they said, that sounds like fun, but the scripts that they had, they were all farces.
Yeah.
You know, George Gallo had originally written a farce. Mm-hmm. And that was still at the center of it. And Will and Martin wanted to be in an action movie.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so I got the call one afternoon. Can you come in now? And I literally at this moment, I was on my way back from a little league practice on a team I was coaching. And mm-hmm. my back hurt because I had just thrown about 100 fastballs. And he says, wherever you are, can you come over to Disney now? And I said, as long as you can have a bag of ice. Serious.
That's so funny.
And I sat down, and they threw it at me. They said, look, we've got a window. We've got a director. We've got Miami. We've got a production office we're putting together. We just don't have a script. Are you willing to just drop everything you're doing right now and jump in and do this? And I was actually in the middle of taking a brief break because I was writing my first novel. Mm-hmm. So I jumped in and said, sure. And we had a very short window of time. We had only 5 weeks of prep.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I heard from like commentaries and interviews that Will and Martin were really just kind of throwing stuff at the wall.
It was that was kind of the process. We were, within days, I was in Miami. Mm-hmm.
and with no script and not much supervision,
which is good.
And just Martin and Will, who weren't there yet, and Michael, who was casting the dog parts and building sets for scenes that I hadn't yet written.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
Seriously. And so it was really kind of done completely backwards, but there's a line in the movie where, you know, the two guys come in and Joey Pants,
yeah.
Yeah, yells at them, say, just do what you do, only faster. That was an actual line from Jerry when I asked him that first day. I said, okay, I can do it, but 5 weeks and blah, 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 blah. And he said, looked at me and says, just do what you do, only faster. So that was sort of like every time I saw Jerry, I said, I'm doing what I'm doing, only faster.
Nice. How involved was Bay in this whole process?
Bay was involved he wasn't involved in the, you know, of course, Mr. Bay has his own. Now Mr. Bay is big, giant Michael Bay.
Yeah.
So, you know, the world gets rewritten. History has probably gotten rewritten a bit. Michael was pretty much relegated to prepping different things.
Okay.
And being involved in some casting. Don especially did not at one point want Michael, you know, because Don was the genius. Mm-hmm. Didn't want him butting himself into the film part. The content or story part. And Don came in just like the weekend before we started shooting. Mm-hmm. And liked a lot of it and sort of got it. But Don hadn't been around at all involved in the process. So he came in just days before we started shooting and blew it up.
Wow.
And then I began putting it back together again as a, you know, from Don's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so Michael, there was the first 3 or 4 weeks of shooting. It was, Michael, here are your pages. Go shoot them. Please don't let the actors go too far off script. You know, because when they did, sometimes there was a few scenes that one ended up on the cutting room floor.
Right.
Because Michael let Martin and Will go off the page to the point where there was no way to link it to the scene before and after.
Right.
So there were moments when I had to, there was a couple days where I would went in and I had to circle certain lines of dialogue in the morning.
Just and like make sure this gets said.
Michael would work late the first day so much. Michael's like, was a crazy mad shooter. I mean,
yeah.
The guy could get incredible amounts of film.
Yeah.
You know, in the can so fast. And so he'd work everyone to death on a Monday. So we were working splits already by Tuesday.
Oh, Jesus.
So you had time to go in that morning and say, okay, you know, so I'd sit down with Don and we'd circle lines in the scene and say, look, dude, if you miss these lines,
we're done.
If the actors aren't there to say the lines, then we have no scene. We can't link it because that movie really is held together with scotch tape.
With string and tape, literally.
It pretty much is. And, you know, brilliant editor, Christian Wagner, brilliant editor. Because, I mean, he made scenes that didn't look like they were going to cut at all.
Right.
Come together. And that's kind of how the film was made. It was really written like that. About halfway through the process, there was almost like a script. It was almost together.
You know, the funny thing is while you were shooting shooting Bad Boys, I was in Miami. I lived in there at Miami at the time. And I was just starting out. Just starting out my film career. And I just heard about it. And I heard Bad Boys 2, obviously, was even more so. Because when they came back with a vengeance in Miami. But
and then they did blow up your street. There really wasn't that much. We didn't have the money to blow up that much. Movie was made for only like, I think, $18-19 million all in.
Yeah, back in the day. But I remember seeing that, I going to the theater and seeing that, and it was just so much fun. And that, you know, that movie made Will a star.
It did, even though he was going to be a star anyway.
somewhere, but that was the trigger. That was the trigger.
If you saw Will, if you'd ever sat down with him and worked with him, it was sort of like, oh, my reaction to Will after the first couple days of rehearsal and hanging out with him, it was like, okay, this guy is a racehorse. He just doesn't quite know how to go fast yet, but very clear. Racehorse.
Yeah, you're just like, he hasn't figured that he can run really fast just yet.
He hasn't figured out how to run really fast yet. He could tell, I know I'm a racehorse. I know I've got these mad skills. You know, I'm working my way through them right now. And no, very self-possessed, very confident,
now,
very cool, very fun, really nice guy. Saved my bacon a few times. Let me tell you. Stories I can't tell
on air.
Yeah.
So you also did the sequel to one of the most iconic action movies of all time, Die Hard.
Yeah.
You know, how did it feel getting that call? Because I mean, literally, Die Hard is a masterpiece.
It is, and it was actually still in theaters, and I'd already seen it twice when I got the call. And the reason why I got the call is because I was the baby writer with no credits. And I guess, according to Larry Gordon, mm-hmm. And Lloyd Levin, they thought or guessed that I had the skill to pull it off, at least the talent. Mm-hmm. But the genius behind it, and I'm just going to give credit away again, mm-hmm. Was because the movie was still in theaters and Leonard Goldberg was running the studio at the time. Leonard, who I to this day adore, who's mm-hmm. one of the greatest people in my career, mm-hmm. just as a mentor. But I didn't know him then. Anyway, Leonard wasn't willing to really even start development of a sequel of the movie. He didn't feel the movie was quite tested yet, but Larry felt they were going to need one. Mm-hmm. Also, as you very well know, if they're doing a sequel and if they're announcing a sequel that they're going to start writing one. Mm-hmm. It's a feeding frenzy of all the agents and all the other.
I don't know. It gets
busy and not very conducive to getting it done.
Right.
So Larry Gordon said, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm Larry Gordon. I used to run the studio. I've got swag. And I've got this book called 58 Minutes that I think might make a really good Die Hard. And I got this writer who doesn't cost very much. So I'm just going to go to the studio and tell them I want to develop this book into a potential movie. It's not going to cost much. This guy doesn't have any credits, so to speak, yet. And that was a time when they were willing to, yeah, Larry, go ahead. It's not going to cost much. So they'd throw, you know, a few bob at it. And meanwhile, Larry was saying to me, okay, whisper, whisper. They just think they're developing 58 Minutes. You and I know we're doing Die Hard 2.
That's brilliant.
Because by the time you're done with the script, they're going to want Die Hard 2.
So that was the exact,
you know, talk. And I was like, okay, you know what you're doing.
I just work
and
here. Fine.
Seriously. Then Joe Roth came in and took over. And one of the first things Joe Roth said when he came in is, I need Die Hard 2. And Larry said, funny you should say so. And there it was. He had it. He just gave it to him right there. And it was greenlit.
Wow. That's the story behind Die Hard 2.
I delivered, but the real genius was Larry.
Larry was the one who saw it.
He saw all the gears, you know, and all the storm clouds and could read the weather and see the future. And again, the movie was in theaters only 3 weeks when I got the call.
Because it was a huge hit right off the bat.
It wasn't a huge hit right off the bat. It was a surprise right off the bat. Movies didn't blow up.
Yeah, they weren't $100 million openings back then.
They didn't. Well, and yeah, I mean, all in, Die Hard only made 85 domestic. I mean, or so, roughly. It took a while to get to that number.
But when it hit video.
Screens and
when
stuff.
It hit video, but when it hit video and cable, forget it.
But 3 weeks in, the studio wasn't willing to commit yet. To a sequel with this Bruce Willis guy.
Yeah, exactly. That was Bruce's kind of big.
People liked the movie, but they just weren't, you know, but Larry said, this is going to be big. I know.
And you were also brought into kind of, I guess, ghostwrite or on the Live Free or Die Hard, right?
I worked. Well, no, I didn't ghostwrite that. Okay. There just was a lot of guys who worked on it. I'm the guy who broke Mark Bomback's script.
Okay.
Okay. That's a funny way of saying it. I did a version of Die Hard 3 that there's very little of left in that movie. Uh-huh. At one point, but there's a lot of people who worked on versions of Die Hard 3. Uh-huh. And at one point, when I was in the middle of shooting Hostage with Bruce mm-hmm. came to me and dropped the script on my lap on the set and said, "Can you read this?"
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And it was Mark Bombeck's Die Hard 4.0, which is what it was called then. Uh-huh. And they thought that title was so clever too. Did studio was so like, that's such
it's
a cool
so,
title.
It's
Die
so kind of internet. It's so,
I know.
Yeah, it's so meta.
And 3 hours later, we were having a discussion in his trailer. You know, Bruce didn't want to do, shouldn't I do another Die Hard? It was one of those things. And I didn't want to see another Die Hard. I didn't want to write another Die Hard.
Right.
And I was kind of trying to talk him out of it and me out of it. But he then asked the question, well, what kind of Die Hard would you want to see? So I began to riff. Mm-hmm. I was going to make another Die Hard. This is what I would do. And the next day, literally, the next day was a Friday. We were at Fox and I was with Bruce, with Tom Rothman, and Bruce was saying, this is the Die Hard 4 I want to make. And Tom Rothman was looking at me like, you asshole, you broke my Die Hard. And after I got done breaking it and a lot of other stories that went into whether or not it was a good version of Die Hard or not, my version, and Bruce had dropped out of it again, you know,
right.
And another release date had been botched and, you know, eventually he wrote Bruce back in and was able to make and did what he wanted to do, which was make Mark Bombeck's script.
Nice.
That's why Mark gets credit on it. I actually wrote a letter to the guild during that. It was a massive arbitration. All these writers were jumping in trying to get credit.
Of course.
And I actually wrote a letter saying, this is Mark Bombeck's script. I should know. I was one of the guys who tried to take it apart and mess it up. And in the end, this is the movie they wanted to make, and Mark should get sole credit.
And there you go. Now, are you on set for a lot of these big movies as a writer?
Not the Die Hards. Well, I was already fired by then. Mm-hmm. But Bad Boys, yeah, and Hostage, I didn't leave that movie until it was in previews. I was not allowed to leave that. I was on the set every second. I got one day off.
And were you writing, they always ask you, hey, what, can you do a touch up on this or what do you think of that?
Well, since I'm there, I mean, there's always a writer on the movie, but since I was there and I had a French director and I had a very bullheaded movie star who, you know, liked having me around and liked having me to fight battles with him or for him. Mm-hmm. You know, there were a lot of little changes and stuff, but on that movie, whether you love it or hate Hostage, which people tend to either love or hate it, that was the movie we really went out to make. And, you know, there it is. And, as a writer, I probably will never get, unless I wrote and directed the movie myself and had complete control, I probably would never have that kind of sway on a movie with a director and a movie star again.
Got it. Yeah, so that was an anomaly.
To the point where it was out of control. To the point where it was like, I couldn't leave. I had other assignments. I actually lost money on Hostage.
Oh, literally. Wow. Because you could have been working on other movies.
I had other assignments I was supposed to do, and they would not. I was supposed to be on the set for the first week.
Right.
And, you know, go. And you know, Bruce was like, no, you can't leave. And then Florent would say, no, you can't leave. And this went through all the production and then into the edit room.
and in the test screenings.
Jesus.
Yeah.
You were a hostage.
Actually, it's a 5-part blog that you can read on my – you can read it for free on my site, or you can buy the book, The Smoking Gun.
Which, yeah, I was going to talk about that in a little bit.
Which is, you can't read it on my site. You can only read it in the book.
Because
that's there's a 5 or 6-part blog called Writer Held Hostage that is in The Smoking Gun, which tells a lot of the stories of how I couldn't get off that movie.
Wow.
All the way to Arbitration with Robert Kraes, and it was just...
Now, Arbitration, and I've heard many other writers talk about Arbitration. Can you explain a little bit to the audience what Arbitration is with the Writers Guild?
Okay.
In a nutshell.
One word. Hell.
That's what I've heard from everybody who's ever dealt with it.
Well, it's so antithetical to writing.
Right.
It's so antithetical to collaboration. It becomes this legalistic process that writers are succumbed to, you know, if they want to receive credit. And not only it pits writers against writers, mm-hmm. and then studios are able to use the conflict to their own advantage. Mm-hmm. In that, that's why they offer these. They use it to their advantage in that they will pay you less money up front for the movie and then say, but if you get a credit, we'll give you this bonus. So if they put the carrot on the stick for the writer who might have only contributed 20%, something that the guild would not consider credit worthy, mm-hmm. but try and make a case that maybe you contributed 33% or maybe 50%, depending upon the standard required. And to then go in and fight for it. So the studios are also part of it, but it's not fun. And, you know, it's imagine going in and, you know, anyone out there who's written anything and then having to go in and defend what you've written on paper to other writers, to a faceless panel of 3 writers on paper and explain why you deserve credit instead of that guy.
Wow.
It's not fun at all. It stops everything in your life for the period of time. And it's also created an industry of people who do nothing but write arbitrations for other writers.
There's a whole industry around it.
Yep.
Jesus, man.
And I've been on both sides. I've actually done arbitrations.
You have written arbitrations?
No, I've read arbitrations. I've served as an arbiter.
Oh, God.
It's
not fun.
No, but you want to be fair, and you know, because if you've been in one, you really feel like okay, or maybe if you've been in one and felt like you were on the wrong side of it, mm-hmm. or maybe felt like you got on the right side of it because someone did it right.
Right.
You sort of feel like you know you're going to be a good juror and help make a good decision.
Now, let me ask you a question: are you any good at pitching when you go in and pitch? And if you are
good,
now
I've decided I suck.
You used to think you were good.
I think it's just a different world to pitch now. If I have to go in and pitch the whole movie, which I kind of think you need to do almost, mm-hmm. I'm not good at it.
Got it.
You know,
it's not like the player, like Robert Altman's a player where at the beginning of that opening scene, where you see writers just coming in like, so there's a girl, she's beautiful. She gets drunk. Don't get her drunk.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you go in and you used to. I used to be able to. My whole thing was I would try and pitch characters and a first act that would leave everyone with a nice question mark. And if it was a good jumping off point, yeah, I had the rest of the movie. But that became a really energetic and exciting discussion in the room. Instead of you're looking at blank faces,
right.
who again, as you're telling the story, they're trying to quantify it for their boss in their heads. Do I like it? Do I not like it? Can I quantify it? Can I sell it? Can I, you know, and tell it to them in a way that they can, you know. And there's at one point during the pitch, I'm like, if you're not engaged in the pitch as in involved in asking questions, I'm sort of like, you must be bored. Now, other people are brilliant at it. I've been in pitches with other writers. Uh-huh. You'd sit there and sit down for 45 minutes and just spin a tale and leave you breathless.
Right.
And that's a, yeah, that's a talent I do not possess to do it that way. I've gotten it done, but boy, I would do everything I possibly could to not have to be in that situation.
Now, when you've written a load of action movies, like how do you approach writing big action sequences in these kind of studio movies?
I wrote an interesting blog about that recently just because I got asked that for the 9 millionth time.
Sorry.
Excited. No. It's the most. No, I never get. It's the question I get asked the most.
Okay.
So anyone who's listened to this podcast, if they go.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
To my website and read Action Speaks, there's a longer version of this answer.
I'll put it in the show notes.
But go to my website and just look up Action Speaks in the blog section. A good action sequence, because when I wrote my first action film, which was that Die Hard thing.
Mm-hmm. That little Die Hard thing, yeah.
I hadn't written one before. But it's... the ones I like and the way I prefer to approach them is that they're, it's a suspense film. And the best action is like writing a great scene in a suspense film. The only difference is the conflict engages and blooms in action in, you know, almost sort of like combusts.
Mm-hmm.
And also then creates another problem for your character. You know, a good action film, unless it's the final action film of the scene, a good action scene, unless it's the final scene of the film, shouldn't resolve. It should create a bigger problem that needs to be solved, that eventually needs to be handled in action. It also only works, can you talk about what's first character or plot,
mm-hmm.
if your character is deeply engaged and involved, which is why, again, a suspense scene only works if you have a sense of suspense with what's going to happen with your character. How is your character going to behave? If you've just got a whole lot of really great stuff happening, but you don't have a character engaged in it, some people would call that stakes. I call it characters with different agendas oftentimes, fighting for some form of supremacy. If you've got that kind of conflict in that scene, if you don't have that kind of conflict with characters injected into that scene, then it'll lay flat.
Kind of like when giant transforming robots fight for 30 minutes.
Yeah. I'm not making, but you.
I can say that.
Who went there, and you can incur Michael Bay's wrath.
I've no problem. I've
wrath
actually
of, the wrath of Bay.
The wrath of Bay with Bayham. I actually am, and a lot of people. I've actually wrote a whole article post about it. I truly believe that Michael Bay is a genius in what he does.
Yeah,
and I think he changed the game for action.
Right.
It's ever since The Rock and Armageddon, specifically The Rock, action movies changed the way they're shot. I mean, everyone tries to steal his. Right. Style.
Oh, and you can see it. You can see it movie after movie.
Movie after movie. He is him and Tony Scott both changed the game in the way action was shot in the 90s and moving forward. Do I like all of Michael Bay's movies? No, they're not. Sometimes they're not the great. I still think The Rock is probably his best movie, other than Bad Boys, of course, which Bad Boys is up there as well. But at a certain point, like Armageddon is just fun popcorn. I mean, it's ridiculous. The movie's ridiculous, but it's so much fun. To watch. But I do think he is a genius in what he does. I think, like a lot of times, directors get a little bit, they drink too much of their own Kool-Aid. And I think possibly with a 35-minute action sequence with giant Transformers, which don't have as big of a stake as they should, I think that's where certain things go wrong. But
can I tell you where I think Michael Bay's real genius is?
Please.
I mean, whether you like his movies or not, and there's certainly people who don't like his movies, he's, with exception of two movies, he's been wise enough to tie his big giant ego and machine all to either a bigger ego or a bigger filmmaker. He's had either Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer over his shoulder. And Jerry's a genius, by the way.
Yeah,
Jerry is a genius. I've seen it because I've seen it in action. Mm-hmm. Jerry is a genius.
Mm-hmm. No doubt.
And so is Don. But there's a certain genius that Jerry, you got to kind of sort of be there to see. Mm-hmm. And then, with the Transformer films, Spielberg's always been there.
Yep.
And, other than that, the two films that Bay have made that haven't done well have both been films where he didn't have those Godfathers.
The Island and
yeah.
Pain and Gain, right?
Right. So, I'm not saying he can't succeed without them because he's been extraordinarily successful. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a certain wisdom to saying, you know what? There's a bit of a comfort zone here that I can, that there's that Godfather who can come in and whisper in my ear and say, maybe that's too much.
Maybe you should pull back here.
Maybe we should have, maybe I'm not feeling a heartbeat here, so maybe we should go find one.
Yeah.
Or, and I think that's, that's something that's not a knock on Bay. Mm-hmm. I think that's where credit's due.
Well, no, I think that's a really great observation because you're right, and it's a smart director to always have someone, whoever that person might be, who's smarter than you around
right.
you. I mean, that's the key to any great leader.
Right,
is always have people who are smarter than you around you.
Right, and on those Transformer films, Lorenzo de Bonaventura and Mark Verratian are no idiots.
No,
either. So,
of course. Of course, of course. Now, tell us a little bit about your Smoking Gun book. I saw it on your website. I was interested about it.
The Smoking Gun book is a lot of people have been asking for a long time, we're going to put my blogs into book form. And eventually, I just sort of succumbed to my blogs are repurposed. Mm-hmm. On Script Mag, like 3 or 4 months after I write them, because the woman who runs Script Mag, Jeannie Bowerman, is one of my favorite people on the planet. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, and then it was sort of like in this publishing company, F&W Media, owns Script Mag and Writer's Digest and a few other things. And so they came along and said, will you please let us publish them in a volume? So we put together the first one.
And there you go.
Will there be two and three or whatever? Who knows?
Now, you do write a lot of novels as well. You're a very successful novelist. Is there a different process when you're writing a novel versus a screenplay?
Yes and no. The basic process of get up, write it, rewrite it. Mm-hmm. You want to make it, if it's not compelling, then do it again.
Right.
And why is, my whole thing is, whether you're reading a script or a book, I want the reader to turn the page. They gotta feel compelled to turn the page. Whatever the process or
platform.
Or platform or architecture of the pieces. If it's not compelling, then someone's gonna put it down. It's tiring to read crap. So
yeah.
So that's the same process. Though the process of writing straight narrative and fiction is, movies are sight and sound only. Highly constructed.
Yes.
The elasticity of language that you have in just writing fiction and not being subject to just sight and sound only is, really fun. It's fun to do. It's fun, obviously. And it's also a direct connection with readers because the people who are reading your screenplays aren't necessarily reading it to be entertained.
Right, it's a job or it's a product, right?
Again, they're the quantifiers. They're there to tell, give it to their boss or give it to their client or
yeah.
or get someone involved or give it to a financier. They're all looking to move that ball up the hill. Mm-hmm. Someone who's reading your work, whether it be a blog, my blog, or my books, are reading them to be entertained.
Right.
So that's the other real difference between doing the two. There's a real direct connection with your audience.
Now, if you were going to give one piece of advice to a screenwriter starting out today, what would that be?
Stop. I've always wanted to say that. I've never said that. I've been asked that a lot. I've done a lot of panels.
No, just stop. No. Go get a real job.
No.
Serious,
no, I would say I would give a few pieces of advice, mm-hmm. one of which is the most talented people in Hollywood aren't the most successful people in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
In show business, it's the most relentless people.
Yep.
So you need to channel and find that bit of relentless inside of you.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And always, and feed it and mm-hmm. care for it and bathe it and clean it and make sure it's ready to go up and rip assholes again tomorrow. Because that, if you're, because it's so competitive, you've got what's going to make you get up and do it in the morning. Or if you're not even there yet and you've got some other job, you know, mm-hmm. what's, I'm blown away by, I mean, I, the people that I know who have not second jobs, they have careers, actual careers, and they're writing on the side and trying to push that ball up the hill.
Right.
I just had odd jobs when I started. Then I started making a living at it and haven't looked back.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who have real live jobs and they have to find and curry that competitive passion. And that competitive passion should also be there to make sure this is the other side of that relentless thing is. People ask me, you know, when should I send the script out? Is it, how do you know it's good yet? Well, is it awesome? Is your work awesome? Your work better be awesome. Make your work awesome. If your work isn't awesome, then it's not going to get noticed. What makes you special? What makes your work stand out? In some way, in some form, it needs to flat out be awesome.
Period.
Not okay. Not, yeah. I mean, back in the day, I'm such a dinosaur.
Yeah.
Back when I was a pup, they would throw money at people with talent and drive. Mm-hmm. I had talent and drive, and I got going. Now they don't have the patience for talent and drive. They expect you to come in ready to go.
They don't want to have to nurture and work you.
Yeah. I got lucky. I had some great people with me. I worked with them. I learned. I'm still learning. But still, there was not – you need to come in and be really good. You need to be great. You need to be special. What makes you stand out?
What's your voice?
Because they're reading thousands and thousands of crappy screenplays every day.
Mm-hmm.
Why does yours stand out? You know, and is it your voice? Is it your ability to you know, is it your perspective? Is it your ability to write a great action scene?
Mm-hmm.
Is it, you know, there's – got to be something in it that makes people go, that's interesting. Why am I remembering that script?
Well, let me ask you a question. Let me ask you a question about what's like, I remember the olden days, the Shane Black days, you know, back when, you know, Shane was getting
$3 million
and Joe Esterhaus. I mean, these guys were getting.
Those are my days.
Yeah. They were making like obscene amounts, $2 million, $3 million, $5 million for scripts that Joe Esterhaus, God, my God, he made millions for movies that never got made.
Yep.
I know more about that than you can realize. Yeah, I mean, it was obscene. I thought those days were kind of over, but now Max Landis is starting to come back out with these kind of ridiculous deals as well for his movies and his voice. So do you think that are those days going to start coming back or is he just an anomaly?
Back.
Huh?
Because those days are always going to come back in one form or another. It is cyclical. People do want to watch filmed entertainment. Mm-hmm. They do want to watch. There's, you know, there's a lot more interactive entertainment, but passive entertainment has been around since campfires.
Sure.
People want to hear a good story. People want to see a good story. They want to be told a good story and be moved.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Whether they're watching it on their phone or watching it at a drive-in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's still going to be that. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, and those voices are going to be found, and whether they're found in, you know, the work of Max Landis, or they're found by the Weinsteins, you know, mm-hmm. who probably burn in hell, but they they did find Quentin and got, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And that, you know, that's happened. Whoever found and decided to, you know, I'm in love with with Sam Esmail. It's like Mr. Robot, I think, is brilliant. And here's a guy who just seemingly came out of nowhere practically and is running a show and doing something that's brilliant with this very original voice. Those are going to stand out.
Yeah, Vince Gilligan.
There you go. It's another one.
Yeah.
You need to have the patience to with and the craft to stay in there and withstand those cycles and beatings until maybe your voice comes out in its own way.
Yeah, like Vince had been around forever. I mean,
he's
been working in X-Files, and I mean, he was working. He's a working writer, and then all of a sudden, he got the idea for Breaking Bad.
And Cranston, he was around forever.
I mean, Jesus,
And no one knew Cranston could do that but Vince Gilligan and Bryan Cranston, and then boom.
And the rest is history. That.
So, you know, sometimes those voices come early. I mean, I'm a big fan of film acting.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, you know, Anthony Quinn, who was always a great actor,
mm-hmm.
when he reached his moment and he said, I finally think I understood you know, how to control the quiet and how to, you know, and that's when he suddenly went from being a really solid British actor to this frickin' genius who went off these runs of characters,
mm-hmm.
you know, from Shadowlands to obviously Silence of the Lambs, you know, to Remains of the Day. I mean, these great roles
were at
an advanced age. He found his voice fine.
Yeah, Hopkins. Yeah, I mean, how old was he when he did Silence of the Lambs? I mean, he was in his 50s, right?
50s or something like that. But again, sometimes it comes early, sometimes, and you see people with these voices, they start and then they burn out.
Yeah, and this is not an easy business.
And then sometimes maybe, I'm still waiting to, you know, who knows, maybe I'm still waiting to find my voice. I've written what you would consider a bunch of programmers. You know, mm-hmm. I think with my books, you know, with my Lucky Day series,
mm-hmm.
I think I finally sort of found my voice. Like, okay, this is what I really, now I feel like I'm, there's something here that's interesting that I'm saying that's worthwhile and valuable and whatever. You never know when that's going to happen. I think as a writer, you got to kind of sort of also work at it and be patient. I mean, Lin frickin' Manuel Miranda, who's obviously got more press than anyone can imagine right now, said something really cool in that 60 Minutes thing he did. If those who don't know who he is, he's the guy who behind Hamilton.
Oh God, he's really remarkable.
He really is brilliant. But he said something, and this may not be his line. He may have been someone else's line.
Mm-hmm.
But they asked him about writing. He says writing is like the rusty water coming out of the faucet. Okay,
yeah.
And write until the water's clear, and then keep the clear.
I saw that 60 minute. I remember that.
And as a writer, I went ding.
That's perfect.
That makes such sense. That makes such sense for so many people. You know, sometimes it takes a long time to get there. Just be patient and grind.
Yeah, I just had Jim Ouels on. On the show. I don't know if you know Jim or not.
I know
Jim, but he said something similar. He gave some great advice about how to get through, how to write, and he basically goes: write your first draft, put it away. Write another movie, first draft, put it away. Write a third movie, first draft. Don't stop, write it away. Now go back to the first movie.
That is brilliant advice.
And he goes, now you're a better writer.
Brilliant advice.
Because if you,
I always call it, don't be a one-trick pony.
Yeah.
Just don't, as in the script you've been working on for 8 years, stop.
Oh, God, I know.
Okay? Stop right now.
Yeah.
Go write 3 or 4 more things and then go back to it. You know?
Then you're a better writer.
You'll be so much better at it. Don't be that guy who can just that one thing. A writer is someone who can write lots of things.
Right.
I think that is a much clearer, cleaner version of mine. I will steal it and use it.
Yes, you should. It's great. I'm going to ask you a couple questions that I ask all my guests.
Okay.
What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in life or in the film industry?
Patience.
Good
more
answer.
In life than anything else.
Uh-huh.
Patience. And I'm still learning it every day.
Yep.
I pray about it.
And life does tend to teach you that lesson.
Yeah, especially children, those things. But yeah, patience, you know. Not sit back and watch it go by, patience, but just slow down, be patient. There is tomorrow. you know, there is tomorrow and then there's tomorrow, and just get up and do it again.
Exactly.
That's that answer.
All right. And then what are your three favorite films of all time?
I hate this question. I hate this question. I hate this question. I hate this question.
Three movies that tickle your fancy at the moment.
Okay. Because there's always, there's one, period, Once Upon a Time in the West.
Great movie. God, what an amazing opening sequence.
It's the, and those of you who haven't seen it.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Okay. Don't see it until you've watched in order for a few dollars more, Fistful of Dollars.
Yep.
Then watch a few dollars more.
Yep.
Then watch Good, the Bad, the Ugly. Mm-hmm. Not the truncated versions. Mm-hmm. And then once you've kind of built up to it, then when you see Once Upon a Time in the West, make sure it's a great sound system and a great screen, because that score is unbelievable.
Oh, sir. Oh,
the use of sound in that original sequence, that opening sequence, and everything else, that movie is just, to me, the greatest opera ever. So, and I cry when I see it. So there's that movie. Mm-hmm. Then everything else is hard. Mm-hmm. So I'll throw out things that really tickle my fancy.
Okay.
I'm a huge fan lately of, I can't watch No Country for Old Men enough.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
It fits my, I think it kind of, the novels I write mm-hmm. have that sort of noirishness to them. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's about that thin line between doing right and wrong and the road it can take you down. And I think that movie does it in so many ways and on so many different levels.
Oh, yeah. And created one of the greatest villains of all time.
Yeah, that you can still watch. It's just that movie. What's better in the movie? The directing, the writing, the performance, the homages to Cormac McCarthy's work in it?
No, it's running on all cylinders.
Tommy Lee Jones, it's just what came for though the dime walked in, coin walked in with you. I mean, like, God, I just go crazy in that movie.
Okay.
And then there's a lot of close thirds, you know. I guess I would go, I'm going to go to maybe the movie that made me want to make movies, mm-hmm. which would be Goldfinger.
Oh, I love Goldfinger, man. That's a great movie.
I mean, what made me want to be a writer was Ian Fleming. Mm-hmm. Those are the first books I ever read in my life that I wanted to read, make me read another book, because I wasn't a reader then. But, you know, when I was a kid, but Goldfinger was like, that was sort of like, wow. I mean, to a young man, you know, with hormones.
Oh,
and
yes.
And dreams and living in a tiny town. And like, you see that and you kind of think, the world is possible.
Yep.
So that was the one that made me want to make movies. So I guess those will be my three.
And where can people find you, man, online?
DougRichardson.com.
Pretty simple.
I got to it before all the other Doug Richardsons in the world did. And there's a lot of us.
Yes, there is. You got on the bandwagon early.
Got there early. And yeah, and you know, if you're a fan of the movies, if you like good, really crime fiction, I really suggest you go to my site and pick up a Lucky Day book.
Awesome.
And I promise you will be entertained.
Doug, man, it's been a pleasure talking to you, man. It's been a lot of fun geeking out with you, and you've been dropping some great knowledge bombs. So thank you so much, man.
It has been a geek fest, hasn't it?
It has a little bit of a geek fest.
It is. All right, pal.
Thank you, man.
All right, take care.
I had an absolute ball talking to Doug, man. He was so cool. And the stories from the sets, from the Die Hard set, from the Bad Boys set, it was great. I heard all these stories about Bad Boys because I was in Miami when they were shooting it, and I had heard all of these stories about how Michael Bay had made it and all these kind of, like, you know, originally for John Lovitz and Dana Carvey and all these kind of things. And it was really great to hear straight from the horse's mouth what actually happened on that set, because Bad Boys is one of my favorite movies. One of my favorite action movies, definitely one of my favorite 90s action movies without question. And you know, there's no transforming robots in that one. but anyway, guys, so I hope you enjoyed it. Hope you got a lot of good information out of that episode. Thank you, Doug, again for being a guest and dropping those knowledge bombs. And the show notes for this episode are at indiefilmhustle.com/BPS003. And there you can get links to anything we discussed in this episode. And please do not forget to go to screenwritingpodcast.com and subscribe to this podcast and leave us a good review. It really helps us out in the iTunes ranking and helps get the word out on this podcast and the work that we're trying to do by helping as many screenwriters as humanly possible. And as always, never stop writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenplay Podcast at bulletproofscreenplay.com. That's BULLETPROOFSCRENPLAY.com.